Okay, if I could have everybody's attention briefly. Y'all know the United Youth Camp rule? When the hand goes up and everybody raises their hands, and when you raise your hand, you shut up. And then we can quiet a room full of noisy kids in about 5 seconds. All the camp director has to do on stage is raise his hand, and they start raising their hands and quieting down. It's the adults that we have to get after when we're at camp. The kids know the rule. Anyway, before we start the study, if you'll all rise, I'll just go ahead and ask God's blessing on it. Heavenly Father, we thank you for a wonderful day of fellowship and studying your word and savoring the overall spiritual experience of the Pentecost weekend. And we look forward so much to the second Sabbath of this double Sabbath weekend tomorrow with the holy day itself. Please bless now this Bible study we have. We look more into the history of Israel and of your word and watch the Bible come alive in our minds as we appreciate all that you have been doing, are doing, and will be doing in the world with mankind and with us in particular. Thank you for the privilege and honor of our calling at this time in history. And we praise you and thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Okay. We will just recap briefly with this part. We're talking about Eber, who was the, I think, great or great-great-grandfather of Abraham. And the term Hebrews, as I mentioned, has almost exclusively been applied to the Israelites, although technically anybody descended from Eber could have been called that. It was used to refer to the Israelites. Now, we saw the names. I've got to try my pointy thing. It's too little. It disappears on that screen for some reason. Oh, well, not to worry. On the right-hand column, you have those names. Now we'll look at a map, and we'll look at where some of those places are. These are just a few of the Eber names, but you'll notice south of Jerusalem, we have the town called Hebron, which gets tossed all over the United States. Even Indiana has a town named Hebron. They call it Hebron there. Spelled the same. But that's Eber. But notice you take off the H, you take off the N, you've got Ebro, a variation of Eber, which is the same name as the Ebro River, which the Saxons, Anglo-Saxons, tend to refer to as the Iber River. So it has two ways of being called. It can call it the Iber, although we say Iber. In English, we have a long I. Very few cultures have a long I. You know, we say Isaac. They don't say Isaac. They say Itzhak. The English speakers do this long I thing. So we call it the Iber, but everybody else calls it the Iber or the Ebro. The Iberian Peninsula, called an Iberian Peninsula because there were a lot of Celts that lived there. The Iberian Celts, they were called. The Celts were part of the tribes of Israel. We have Hibernia here. It was a name for Ireland. York was Eboric. Again, the Eber name. You've got the vowel. Remember, the ancient Hebrew did not have vowels written into the words. When they wrote it, they wrote the consonants. To give you an idea of how challenging it would have been to be a kindergartner learning to read in Hebrew school, you know, a couple of 3,000 years ago, there were no breaks between the paragraphs. It was just one long paragraph. Don't you just hate it when it's just one long paragraph? The only person I allow that to keep my attention is the Apostle Paul. He was the master of a readable long paragraph. But they didn't have paragraph breaks, and they didn't have sentence breaks, which meant they had no punctuation at all. And that's kind of hard. Okay, so the sentence begins here, and the next one starts there, I think. And that's kind of hard. But then you find out, not only that, they didn't have spaces between the words. So they were just letters strung out. And, oh, well, we can do that, you know, for a game. But to read, everything is just one paragraph, all letters stuck together, no breaks between words, no breaks between sentences, no breaks for paragraphs, no punctuation, and no vowels. Not only that, they wrote from the right to the left, not left to the right like we do with Hebrew. The way they knew where the pair of word breaks were, and what the vowel sounds were, is that was handed on by generation to generation. For example, the YHVH, which we translate into the King James Bible as capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, some think that it's Yahweh, but they don't know. Because many, many, many centuries ago, the Jews got superstitious about saying the name of God, and so they stopped. Then they didn't know what the vowels were after a few generations. So nobody knows how it was pronounced. Thus, there's no magic in, you know, being able to say it the correct way, because we don't know. We know what the consonants were, you know, the English versions of the Hebrew consonants. We don't know what the vowels were, because they stopped saying that. So Hebrew was a challenge to read. But again, you've got the Eber, the Hibernia, the Hebrides, inner and outer, the islands in Scotland, Aberdeen, Aber, Iber, Over, Aver, Aberdeen, actually they would say it, Bergen in Norway may even be one, and you've got the Oder River here in Europe, Tiber, Ebro. Anyway, basically you go west and you go north. Remember that they would migrate north and west and then south, some of them. North and west would take them clear over to North America as well. That's just a few of the Eber names. Just a few. There was another Iberia right here that was there for many centuries and it disappeared. Siberia, of course, is up there. Why is it called Siberia? Because some of the tribes were there for a long time. They fought with the Chinese. They built a wall to keep them out, them and the Huns. In fact, some of the Israelites were called Huns. There was one group called the Hephthalites, who were referred to by the Chinese as the White Huns. And they were barbarians from the Chinese point of view because they kept invading all the time. The Hephthalites were one of the last groupings of Israelites to migrate back. They came down from China, and they set up camp around the on the other side of the Caspian is where it was, the Silk Route, and the other side of the Caspian Sea, and then they fought with the Persians. They thrashed the Persians too. They almost toppled the empire. Eventually the Persians subjugated them for a while, and then they, after 100 years, 200 years, they disappeared, came up around and into Europe. Hephthalites is probably the tribe of Naphtali. You look for the name, if you realize that names move through time as far as their sounds, and they will also move even within a language, but they move in languages. Hephthalite, Naphtali, very, very close. And that would have taken them up to be Vikings. Okay. Now, let's look at Omri here. In the Black Obelisk, or Obelisk, in the British Museum, you have an inscription that it's an Assyrian inscription, the tribute of Yehu, or Jehu, as we say in America. Yehu is how it's pronounced in Hebrew, son of Kumri. Kumri is the Assyrian way of saying Omri, the K. Or G sound. You say, what do you mean? Is it K or is it G? Is it a K or a G? It doesn't matter. They're phonetically identical because they're so hard to differentiate. Did you say P or B? And you say, well, you know, make it clear. Well, that's why in the military, what's the code word for the letter B?
Bravo.
Which?
Bravo.
Bravo. Yeah, there we go. So then you know, all right, it's a B. What's the word for P?
Papa.
See? Now you got a sound that you can pin down, but they're too easy to mix up. So Gumri or Kumri, and it spelled either way, Kumri or Gomri. This has been followed for a long time. What that was, and it says Yehu, you say, oh, just a minute. Omri was the father of Ahab, but in Kings, 1 Kings, Yehu is the one who wiped out the dynasty of Omri. He's not related to them. He was a commander of the army that took over the country at the time of Elisha. Excuse me. And that's the case. But from the Assyrians' point of view, you're in the same country. You're a son of Omri, because Omri was the big guy that we remember. So he called him the son of Gomri. The Assyrians called Omri those names. That got morphed into Gomri, Gomri. It's not Gomer. There was a Gomer back in Genesis 10. This is different. This is much later. Gomri, Kimiri. G and K, remember, are interchangeable. So Kimirians, Anglo-Saxons tend to take a C and make it soft at the beginning of a word, except for cat. Did you see where the cat sat? We could say, did you see where the sat sat? But we don't, because it would be confusing. Today, many of the Welsh refer to themselves as the Kimbri. So you see, it's a variation of Omri. And you can track the tribes by that name quite significantly. Especially the Kimmerians, which, when the empire of Assyria was collapsing in the, would have been the late 600s, the high 600s BC, or actually the lower 600s BC, the Kimmerians were breaking free and they swept into Anatolia. Anatolia is for us today central Turkey, Asia Minor. Eventually, they fought back and forth with everybody. Remember, the history of man is a history of wars. Same with the Israelites. Eventually, they crossed the Bosporus and started migrating up and linked up with the Celts. The early Celts were linked up with by the Kimmerian Celts. They were all known as Celts. Or Celts, if you're from Boston. But as in the Celtics. Or do they say Celtics? No, they don't. They say Celtics. Boston Celtics is the Boston Celtics anywhere else. Go figure. Okay. Isaac. I told you Isaac sounds funny in American English or English English. Whatever Sarah has said to you, God told Abraham, listen to her. This is Genesis 22:12. This is an important verse. For... And this then, the addendum to this sentence is a prophecy. In Yitzhak shall your seed be called. In Isaac shall your seed be called. It's pronounced Yitzhak. The first time I ran across that, you know, sometimes you blunder through life and you don't notice things. I was reading the Out of Africa. And it was actually the story of the book. Robert Redford was in the movie. It is kind of an interesting story. But it was written by a certain Yitzhak Denison. I said, what do you mean Yitzhak? It's Isaac. Well, it wasn't Isaac at all. It was Karen. Karen von Blixen, a noble woman from Denmark, writing under a pen name. Oh, thank you. Oh, it's coffee. It's good coffee. A little coffee, a little lemonade, and water for a backup. Okay. Yitzhak Denison, and then I realized, oh, now I understand. Anybody but the English or Americans say Yitzhak or Isaac. We say Isaac, they say Yitzhak. I'm confusing myself. Whatever the case, the consonantal core, remember the consonants that are the core of the Hebrew for Isaac is the SK or the hard SC sound, which sometimes we then soften later. So we'll look for that. Isaac, in the western branch of Isaac, were known as the Scythians or Scythians. From the word Scyth, you get the Scute. The A-E is a Latin ending, so some of the endings were for whatever language it was in. Scotia, as in Nova Scotia, would be a case in point in North America, is based on the word for Isaac. Scotland itself is Isaac. Scandia, which was an old name for Scandinavia, again you have the S-K sound, the Isaac name. In Isaac shall your seed be called. So we're going to look for the name of Isaac, as well as the name of Omri, as well as Eber. Those will be important tracks as you're reading through history. The eastern branch of Yitzhak, or Isaac, which would be on the eastern side of the Caspian Sea over toward China. into Azerbaijan and all the other, the stands. You get over in the stands, Kurdistan and Tajikistan and so on is where they're called today. We're the Sakha. Now, I'll show you in a minute, because we get into archaeology, you'll see why we know Sakha and Scythian or Scythian are the same word. Sakha, 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 east of the Caspian, also known as the Exusa, the Sakhe, the Sakha Sini, the Sakha Senones, the sons of Isaac, or sons of Sakha, and then ultimately the Saxons. Saxons are derived from Isaac. The X works as a K in that sense. So Itzhak, or Isaac, comes down to us as Saxon. And you think, what do you mean, Germans? No. Saxony in Germany was named after Saxons who lived there for a while, and then you move. In 500 AD, they mostly moved into England. And then more of them moved from England later across the United States. They were still migrating. But they left a name behind. And that often is the case. The Israelites leave names behind where they once were. So again, we have historical tracks. That when you know what the names to look for, then you can see where they are as they go along. Now, we get into archaeology, we'll see the connection between Scythian and Sakha. This is a drawing by one of the Rawlinson boys. There were two. George, the historian, and Henry, or Sir Henry to us, he was knighted, who was the archaeologist. And they operated in the mid-1800s. It was Henry Rawlinson that discovered, well, it was everybody knew it was there, but he went to the trouble of exploring it and making rubbings of all the inscriptions that are along that part of the wall there. It's on a cliff that is on the road between Tehran and Baghdad. It's called the Behistun Rock Inscription. And we have a little close-up of the picture. Here's the man responsible for it. He was Darius the Great. We know of a Darius in the time of Daniel. Well, this Darius came much later. This would have been Darius the Third or the Fourth, a couple hundred years after that first Darius. That would have been the early Persian Empire. And these are all the people he conquered. He has lists of names of all the people he conquered. The last one there with a pointy hat. And if you'll note, let me get over here, you note that he's got a pointy hat and he's wearing boots. When you get close and you can inspect it, he's wearing trousers too. The Scythians wore trousers and boots. And what do they think they were? Cowboys? No, Indians. They used bows and arrows, but they rode horses. They wore trousers. And you'll find that almost consistently. The pointy hat, for some reason they like pointy hats too, toques. So that was the picture. It was Darius the Great, early 500s B.C., and the list of nations and tribes that he conquered. Now, Sir Henry Rawlinson did the rubbings, and he came down to translate what he had found. By rubbing, you take a certain kind of special paper and then lead, and you place the paper against the inscription, and you rub it. You can do that on a gravestone. That way you can go back, and sometimes you can read it actually better off the rubbing than you can off the rock because of bits of lichen or what have you that are there. He found that he had three parallel translations in three ancient languages, Old Persian, Susian, and Assyrian. That became the key because he already knew the Old Persian language. He knew the Susian language, as did other scholars. They did not know how to read the Assyrian language, or the Akkadian language, I think was another name for it. So he found out that the first two columns were exact word-for-word translations, which meant the third column was two. And then from that, they learned to translate the Assyrian language. When they did that, they could translate the cuneiform tablets that they had unearthed when they discovered Nineveh. And guess who discovered where Nineveh was in the mid-1800s? Henry. Henry Rawlinson again. He found that. He found, did this rubbing. These boys were prolific. And then his brother would write the histories. That was George Rawlinson. Sir Henry Rawlinson not only did the archaeology on the cliff of the Behistun Rock inscription, and not only located the site of Nineveh, which was then excavated, he also did some preliminary excavations around the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. At that time, he didn't have evidently as much manpower available, so what he would do is sink shafts. They would pick a likely spot near, close to whatever historical site they would be investigating, and they would just dig a deep hole. And whatever they found in the hole would give them some kind of evidence. They didn't have the wherewithal to do a systematic layer-by-layer excavation. In 1973, in the summer, Linda and I were on the Big Dig in Jerusalem. Actually, that's where we got acquainted. She was going to Pasadena Ambassador College. I was at Brickett Wood. And we were digging one day, and our group of eight students were digging in our little section. They mapped it out with pieces of twine, and we just dug a hole straight down to bedrock. And we got down to the bedrock, and we found bones. And then we found an iron grub hoe. There were grub hoes about this big. That's what we were using to move our dirt. We would chip it loose with a pickaxe, and then we'd take it and slide the dirt into a bucket made of rolled rubber tires that would hold about 30 or 35 pounds of dirt. And you tip it up with the last scoop you dragged in. Well, it was exactly like ours, and it was made of iron. And we said, well, this is weird. This is down in really ancient stuff. They weren't supposed to have that then. So we called our dig boss. He was from Hebrew University. He supervised our group of four or five excavation holes. And we said, what do we have here? So he studied the bones. He says, okay, I'll take him in. I'll come back and tell you tomorrow. But I think I know what it is. And he was right. He came back. He said, those were chicken bones. And we said, chicken bones? He said, what were they doing down here? He says, probably left over from lunch. A long time, about 150 years ago. And the shovel head was from the 1800s, and what we think you found is the bottom of the Rawlinson shaft. The rest had caved in, and here we excavated down, found the base of it. So that was kind of cool. You know, added to the year of looking for really ancient stuff, and we're all excited when we found George Rawlinson, or Henry Rawlinson's lunch, or at least the lunch of one of his workers, and a shovel blade. Now, that translated the Babylonian, and Old Babylonian and Assyrian language, and then we found out that the Sakae, were the same people as the Gemiri or the Cimmerians, who were the same people as the Scythians or the Celts, because Celts and Scythians had close connections, so we knew they were the same people already. So essentially, all of those names on the bottom two lines are talking about the tribal movements of the Israelites, naming either after in the Gemiri or Cimmerians after Omri, and the Saka or the Scythians are named after Isaac. So you can see that archaeology factors in as well. George Rawlinson, who was also an archaeologist with his brother Henry, but did mostly wrote the books. We have reasonable grounds for regarding the Gemiri or the Cimmerians and the Sakae of the Behistun Rock as identical with the Bet Kumri. Bet means house of in Hebrew. Kumri mean referring to Omri, house of Omri, of Samaria, or the 10 tribes of the house of Israel. She says that's the conclusion of our research and digging at that time. Now, clan names. I mentioned clans. You had your tribal patriarch. Then you have the sons of the patriarch, and then, in many cases, the grandsons. And those names of the sons and grandsons will then take on clan status within the tribe. Reuben, as an example. Rubari, we find in France, not far from where Paris is. And then his sons were Hanak, Palu, Eliab was a grandson, Hezron, Carmi. And what I have here are names of peoples. Now, when you look at them, okay, yes, that could be extracted as it went through the centuries. Could have been the same name moved down the line. Were found in the tribes of the clans that would be northern France. among the Franks. So that's where they show up in these names over there in italics. Those show up on historical maps at the time of the Franks. Simeon. Remember, Simeon was taken early in the first wave of captivity. Simeon we find in history as the Samnites. Simeon, Samnites, that makes sense. Semnones, Simini, and Simuen. Now, they're still scattered, and many of the Welsh consider themselves to be extracted, or at least historians do, to be of Simeon extraction. Now, we have some of his sons, Nemuel, and notice this one, Jamin. Jemuel. Jamin is the number's name. This is the chronicle's name. Jemuel is the same as Jamin. I mean, it had morphed that much, except it wouldn't be a J sound. It would be a Y sound in Hebrew. So it would be Yamin or Yemuel or possibly the Yam Vikings. There was a group of Vikings called the Yam Vikings. The Vikings were not just of one tribe. They were of a number of tribes during their era of 8 to 1200 AD. Yakin was known in Chronicles as Yarib. Zerah was Zohar in Chronicles. And again, the names that can be found in historical atlases moving across Europe. The Simeon I've singled out, though, because this is excavated in Italy, a Samnite warrior. Before Rome became a republic, the Latiums were a kingdom, and they were trying to flex their muscle and consolidate all of Italy. It took them hundreds of years to defeat the Samnite kingdom. If you were to imagine the boot of Italy, and if a dog bit somebody right on the back of the calf on the boot of Italy, that's where the Samnite kingdom was. It would be the eastern side of Italy, right on the back of the calf of the leg that the country. And that's where they would have been, which we believe there would be a Simeonite kingdom. Now, the Latiums eventually defeated them, and then they left. Israelites were migrators, just like they were during the 40 years of wandering. And if they wasn't where God wanted them yet, then they would move on, and they often did that. Other tribes, Assyrians, were that way too. Gad. Gad, we say with a flat A, almost nobody else uses a flat A in the world. Most languages have an aw sound for our flat A. England, classic case in point. So Gad would be Goth. The D comes out as a hard T in Hebrew, and the TH is also a hard T at the end of a word. So the Goths, we know about the Goths, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, Gothic novels. Hold it, they weren't written by them. But we know of Goths. But that's very close to how you would say the name Gad in anything but American English. It could also be known as a Gut, because the vowel can move between languages. Guti. There was a grouping, a very powerful grouping of elements of tribes during the, 500s to 200s BC, called the Massagete. The Massagete at one point went from where would be today northeastern Iran, where they had lived for a long time, and they went toward China. They disappeared and moved to China. And then about 200 years later, they came back. The Chinese had a name for them. They called them the Yu Chi. They could not say Guti. They evidently don't do the Gu sound. The Chinese don't, and they're very sorry for that. They don't do our sounds well either, because that's just the way you pronounce things in Chinese. So Yu Chi was another name for the Massagete, or the Massaguti. Massa, we would think, probably an element of Manasseh was involved, a league, a confederation between Gad and Manasseh. Also known as Gutons, Gadini. These are the sons of Gad, Zephon. And then notice the ones in parentheses. Those are from Chronicles. These are from Numbers on the outside. Again, showing how often they shift. Now we have some of these Yingling. Notice that? Hold up, we don't have any Yingling beer down here, do we? Okay, that comes from Pennsylvania. It is one of the oldest breweries in America. It's okay. Don't tell the Pennsylvanians I said that, because they think it's the best thing since sliced bread. But Yingling, you can see it has some history to the sound. All right, Judah. Part of the tribe of Judah ended up going into captivity as well. This was the time of Hezekiah. Remember the time Hezekiah took the letter from the Assyrian Empire, or emperor, took it to the temple, and he prayed and read the letter and asked God to intervene. And 3 days later, these lepers came to the city and said that the army out there is dead. 185,000 strong expeditionary force from Assyria, and they all woke up dead. That's what it says in the King James. And behold, they woke up dead. And God sent an angel and killed them all. And then answered Hezekiah's prayer. But that was after the emperor had taken all the fortified cities of Judah. Those would have been the border cities. And in the records of the Assyrians, they took 200,000 people out of those cities and deported them. So you have then, mixed in with the 10 tribes, you have a significant chunk of Jews, which would include Judah and Benjamin, and Levi, no doubt, who are then tossed into the migrations of the tribes. The rest of the Jews remained because God answered Hezekiah's prayer. So that's a tidbit. So we would be looking for something that sounds like Jew or Judah, and there is. When the Saxons and the Angles invaded England, they were accompanied by the Jutes, who came from Jutland, which was another name for Denmark, Jutland. In fact, the British referred to Denmark as Jutland for a long time. One of the most famous naval battles in all history is the Battle of Jutland, when the British Admiralty managed to cross the T on the, that was World War I, if I'm not mistaken, the German Navy. Crossing the T meant that you could bring your battleships with a broadside. You could be firing down the line at the Navy of the enemy. And they destroyed the German Navy badly at that time. So it was called the Battle of Jutland, referring to where the Jutes came from. And they came into England, and they ended up being a part of the English population. So that's one place we can find them, where they were not known as Jews, but they were known as Jutes. Zebulun. Afghanistan in Scythian times was called Zebulistan. So you've got Zebulun right there. He had sons Zeret, Yahil, or Chali, but Elon, probably the most famous. There are groupings of tribes called the Alans or the Alani, and sometimes the Rocks Alani. And one of the very likely origins of where that comes from is his son Elon, who has essentially the last two syllables of Zebulun's name. You've got Elon, becomes Alan, Alani, Rocks Alani, and ultimately Holland. Elon becomes Holland. So it's easy enough to see that that could be a derivation. And you say, well, what if some of that's not right? What if we're inaccurate? Well, I can tell you this. I was just reading a history that takes the name Scythian and gives it a different origin. And I read what the author's reasons were, and I thought, his reasons are no better. In fact, they're not as good as the ones we just use here, which other historians use, who do believe that the 10 tribes have migrated. So when you're tribe tracking, you're looking for lots of tracks that are going in a certain direction. Some of them might be false tracks. You might have a cow walking in with the elk, but it looked like a big elk. So you follow the tracks. Oh, there's a stupid cow. What in the world is that doing here? But look, there are elk tracks beyond. So you were still tracking the elk. So The analysis of these names is very reasonable from historical perspective, the way we're looking at them here, with the superstructure of the Bible is our view of history. Dan. Now, Dan's very interesting. Dan only had one son, of all things. Shushan, which in, notice the change, his name was Shuham, rather, but by the time of Chronicles, 400 years later, Hushim is how his name was said and written. But that's the only son of Dan. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. He will be a serpent in the path, a viper in the path. Now, we always focus on he bites at the heels of the rider, which is the rest. But another thing about serpents in a path is that you can see they were there. Their track is in the dust. And so are Dan's. The Danites, I don't know why they had this proclivity, but they named apparently nothing after anybody but Dan. They were inordinately proud of their patriarch. We got Adina. We got the Danube River. You have the Dnieper and the Dniester and the Don, and the tributary of the Don is the Donay. Dan, all the way around the Black Sea. The Black Sea was colonized, they say, by the Greeks in the 1200s BC. That was the time that Dan was in his ships and was being scolded by Deborah. Now, the southern Greeks, those from down in here versus Athens up there, the southern Greeks, was the main city being Sparta, said that they were descended from the Danai. And there is other historical evidence that they recognized a kinship genetically and racially and historically with the Jews of Jerusalem many centuries later. Danai, D-A-N-I-I, is usually how it's spelled in English letters, that the Peloponnesian Greeks. So you have Greeks that descended from Javan, being the Athenians and the northern Greeks, but the southern Greeks and probably the Trojans as well, it seems to be, the Trojans weren't in Greece, they were over here in Asia Minor on the coast. So the Trojan horse and all that sort of thing, that the Battle of Troy took place over there. The traditions are that those are descended from Dan. Therefore, they opened up the Black Sea and colonized it with naming all their locations after Dan. Then you go up further, and we only have a few of them here, but you have Danzig in Poland. You've got Denmark or Dansmark in Denmark. You've got Dunkirk over here on the coast. Again, if they're seafaring, they're going to have places they go to. London, you've got the Dan name there. Tuatha De Danann, where a tribe of the Irish, early Irish, they call themselves the tribe of Dan. Tuatha De Danann. Donegal Bay is in Northern Ireland. You have a Don River in Scotland. Dundee in Scotland. See, D-U-N-D-O-N-D-A-N doesn't make too much difference what the vowel is. It's the D-N sound. So there are an awful lot of Dan tracks that once again flow north and west, just like Isaiah 49:12 said it, they would move north and west. And then when they come back, they'll come from the north and the west to come back when Christ returns. Danite tradition. I already cited some of it. Some sailed from Greece, from Egypt into Greece before or at about the time of the Exodus. And you think, well, what do you mean they sailed? I thought Moses freed them. Well, and they were slaves and they made bricks. You think they all made bricks? Slaves had to do a lot of things. Joseph didn't make bricks when he was a slave. So where does anybody remember where in Egypt the Israelites were settled primarily? Where? The coast. In the Nile Delta. Goshen was the Nile Delta. It's where the Nile flows north. It's where it goes into the Mediterranean Sea. They were in the Delta area. That meant that if the Egyptian sailors wanted slaves to row in their galleys, then they just grabbed some slaves. They had plenty of them. Some of those slaves would then gain skills in sailing over the course of time. So you look for reasonable explanations. How can this be supported? by the reasonable way in which things happen in human life. And so it's not hard to see where the slaves of Egypt, some of them could end up becoming sailors with the Egyptians and ultimately be able to commandeer sailing ships themselves. And then sort of have a mini exodus to the north. But this was a tradition that was taught in England as history up until the late 1800s. Some colonized the city of Dan, and we know that they were colonizers. In the middle of the book of Judges, it talks about the time that some of the Danites decided to go find a new land. They went into the middle of Israel, and then they moved north, and they stole Gershom, who was acting as a pagan priest. Gershom was actually a descendant of Moses, but he was being a priest for a guy named Micah, not the prophet. So they took him into custody with them, and they took his idol. He had some kind of a silver idol. He said, "You'll be our priest." And so then they went up and they found Laish, I think was the previous name of the city. And when they realized that's a pretty good place to live, they went back, got reinforcements, went up there, wiped out everybody in the city, and then rebuilt the place as their own city, which they named after Dan. Grandpa Dan got the name of everything. So from Dan to Beersheba became the saying, the northern and the southern borders of the nation of Israel, because that was early in the Judges that Dan was settled by the Danites. So then you had, even in Israel, two enclaves of the Danites, one on the seacoast and one in the north of Israel. But it showed that as a tribe, they had a proclivity for wanderlust. They wanted to move, colonize, go places. Some sailed from Israel to the Black Sea, colonized Ireland ultimately as Tuatha De Danann. Most people say it can't be, only Columbus knew how to get out of the Straits of Gibraltar. Well, it was a little before Columbus they figured that out. But nobody, they thought, before that, you know, before the Dark Ages would sail across the ocean because they thought the earth was flat. No, that was a Roman church point. Kept people where they could control them. And when Columbus kind of broke out, well, then they decided they better go control everybody they have found elsewhere. There were ancient peoples who knew how to sail. The Phoenicians, who sailed with Solomon, in league with Solomon. Remember Hiram, the king of Phoenicia, who contributed a great deal of the great beams and lumber needed for the temple and the palaces of Jerusalem. He was a friend of David, and when David died, he was a friend of Solomon. And their navies sailed together, Israelites and Phoenicians together. And the Phoenicians had been great sailors, but some of the Israelites had already been great sailors. The Phoenician triremes means that they had three ranks of oars, so they could sail through the doldrums out in the middle of the oceans. They could row their way through it. Some of them, according to the historical research in archaeology, were up to 600 feet long. That's six times longer than the Mayflower. And how long did the sailing ships of Solomon take to make their circuit and come back? You remember that in 1 Kings chapter 8 or 9, wherever it is? Not one, not two, but count them, 3 years. And what the commentaries say is they would sail around the Horn of Africa and camp for a year and get stuff. And then they would sail back for a year. Do you know sailors that do that? They camp on their ship. They don't sail someplace to camp. Sailors sail, get stuff, sail on. And how long does it do that? Does it take to circumnavigate the globe if you're sailing like a proper sailor? Magellan proved it was 3 years. Well, Magellan didn't really prove it. His men did. Magellan croaked along the way. But his men proved that it was 3 years to take a sailing ship around the earth. And when he did it, because he was being chased by Spaniards, then the others realized, oh, it is round. Well, we can do that too. And so they did. But the ancient world knew things that had knowledge that was lost during the Dark Ages, or what we call the Middle Ages. They had knowledge of how to do that long ago. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan, and why did Dan remain in ships? And there's that reference again that we had looked at earlier. What about Ephraim as far as a clan name? The symbol of Ephraim was the bull. Every tribe had a flag. Every flag had a symbol on it. This was in the time of Moses and Joshua when they were wandering in the wilderness. And they would line up and march very orderly. And they would fall in behind their flag. The flag of Ephraim was a bull. And so they lined up behind that. The bull in Hebrew is Egel. Egel. This is a very probable source, therefore, for the Egoli, the Angli, or the Angles, which is the source of Angleland, or England. England is named after the Angles. Angle can easily be derived from the Hebrew Egel, for bull, which was a symbol of Ephraim. What is the classic characterization of the English in cartooning? It's a guy's name. John Bull. Yes, John Bull. So he carries, even by popular modern reputation, carries that concept of the bull. And here in Jeremiah 31 it says, I have heard Ephraim bemoaning himself. You have chastised me, and I was chastised like an untrained bull. Restore me, and I will return, for you are the Lord my God. Prophesying of a time when the Ephraimites will repent. An untrained bull, again, constantly being associated with Ephraim. Thus, you can track Ephraim by that name, the Angli or the Angles. Ephraim's clans, Skutala, and there are various names here that are found in various parts of England or Scandinavia. Bear in mind that it was from Scandinavia that northern Germany that the Angles and Saxons came in 500 AD and fought with the Celts and drove them over mostly to Wales and the other side of the country. One of the grandsons, however, was Edon. Edon, the E and the A, it was the RN sound. What were the vowels? We don't know, but in English, the scholars think Edon. So then if we think, okay, there have been peoples who have been known by that. The Erne, the Irin, the Ari, the Hiri, and then names in modern geography, Iran, or Iran, as we call it. They call it Iran. Tehran, you got the Iran name in Tehran, which there's another derivative for the reason why it's named that, but when I read that in a recent history book, I was reading the history of Persia, I thought, well, that's a definite possibility that Tehran came from what they say. But they're supposing this and supposing that and supposing the other thing. In other words, they're doing exactly what we're doing. And this is just as strong an argument for the origin of the name for Tehran, the city, is what they had. Erin was another name for Ireland. After it was known as Hibernia, it was known as Erin, from which we get Era today. We drop the N and you got Era. And then Ireland comes after that. Iran, then, would be a significant clan of ancient Ephraim to watch. Becker, Beret, Beradi, Bardi, these are the names you find on these last two on the historical atlases. Tahan is one of the other sons of Ephraim. He had three sons. Tahan, easily the origin of Tutan, Tataris, or Tahuni. So when we say what the Teutonic, and we think we're talking German, we're actually talking people that lived where Germany is for a time and then moved on. And the Germans came in, the modern Germans, and the area is the area of Teuton or the Teutonic, and we think it's German. Bear in mind, Germany had a massive migration to America between 1880 and about 1920. 4.5 million people emigrated to the United States. Now, were they ancient Germans, who we believe to be Assyrians? Probably not. They were probably the Nassites in a holding pattern until God said, okay, now I want you to come over. With the Scots-Irish, which will be part of the population down through here, and certainly a lot of it, because the Scots-Irish came into Philadelphia, went immediately to western Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio, and then moved down the river and then down into what is now West Virginia, Western Virginia, and down here into the Carolinas to a large extent. The Scots-Irish formed the bulk of the Confederate Army, of the rank and file, not the officers. They were different than the officers. And they were a significant portion of the Northern Army, too. It was the Scots-Irish where you had brothers fighting brothers and sons and fathers fighting back in the American War between the states. So where was I? Scots-Irish, migrations from Germany. Tossing this in, it isn't on there. 1.5 million Scots-Irish came to America between, I was just reading this the other day, 1733 and 1775. 1.5 million. And then there were more that came later. But 1.5 million was a significant population pull from parts of Ireland and Ulster, meaning Northern Ireland, and Scotland and Northern England. Bear in mind, the Scots-Irish didn't get along with anybody. And so when they were in England, they would get into trouble with the English and the Highland Scots. They were Lowland Scots is basically what they were. And they get driven to Northern Ireland. Until the Irish got fed up with their raids and their fights and their battles, they would drive them back to England. And they sort of did this for a while. And they got a little bit of momentum. And then they just sailed right on over and landed in America. One historian's theory is that they were the Caledoni. They were elements of the Scots have several names that they say they come from, and Galadone is one of them. And this historian, Israeli historian who studies these things, his name is Yair Davidi, David with a Y on the end, he thinks Galadone is actually a variation of Gilead, Gileadi, Galadone. The C and the G become interchangeable in that sense. Gilead was the half-tribe of Manasseh. Gilead was the home of Jephthah, and Jephthah was a fighting man's fighting man. So you mix in some Danites and maybe some Levites and Simeonites with the Gileadites of Manasseh, and you have people that are just born to fight or born fighting. They were constantly like that in their history. Anyway, Manasseh. Here's Joseph, Usabi. These are various names that you could found on historical atlases going way back that could be derived from Joseph. We won't focus on that as much as Manasseh. Manasseh, Manus, Mani, Massagete, the Massa of Massagete, connected with the Goths, that is. Remember, Manasseh only had one son. His name was Machir, and he had a grandson whose name was Gilead. We just talked about Gilead. So here we have Machir's genealogy. From Manasseh was his son. So the clan of Machir, which was the clan of everybody else, but some of it, the name was carried by part. Gilead, and then we have the Galate, the Galadi, and the Caledoni. The last one being the one in Scotland. Gilead had a whole lot of sons. He was busy. Jezer, or Abiezer in Chronicles. So again, you're seeing a couple of these in the parentheses is how their names changed much later. Helek, Asriel, Shechem, Shemida, Hefner. An interesting one of Manasseh was Zelophehad. Zelophehad became a clan. And he had, and there were five daughters, famous daughters at a certain time, who were descended from Zelophehad. And at the time of the Israelites coming into the Promised Land, they went to their captain of tens or fifties and said, "Our father has no sons, and he will receive an inheritance, a family land inheritance, but when he dies, we have no brothers to inherit it. Will his name therefore be wiped out of Israel?" You know, they were concerned about their heritage and what they would be thought of them or forgotten of them. And can we inherit for our father? Women inherit for the man? Whoa, how could that be? So then they didn't know, so they went up to the captains of hundreds, and he didn't know, and went up to the captain of whatever, all the way up the judicial system within the tribes of Israel in their wandering years, and it came to Moses. This is near the end of the book of Numbers. I think it's 26, but you don't quote me on that. Go look it up. And then Moses said, hey, I don't know. I'm going to go ask God. Moses could do that, you know. And so he did, and God came back with what we call a judgment. He says they may inherit for their father, but they must marry within the tribe of Manasseh. So that was the judgment that God made. Now stop and think about it. Manassite women who were willing to step forward and in a certain sense buck the established system and say, what about this, please? You know, they were the forward ones that were willing to do that. Does that sound like America? I think so. Willing to step forward and make noise, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad. In this case, it was a good day and a reason. Their names were Malah, Tirzah, Hoglah. It's not so complimentary today, but it probably was great then. Milcah and Noah. It sounds just like Noah. Now, how did America get its name? I'm going to talk about the name of Machir, and then I'm going to talk about the name of Manasseh and some other significant aspects. In Hebrew, when you say the people of, you see ah, ha, ha. So the people of Machir would be pronounced ha Machiri, the people of Machir. Now, ha Machiri, we have the Mirgan Siths. So this name, you're looking for Machir, there's a Mirgan. Mirkan, that could be Machir there. Amirigo Skute, which is another way, another language for those, in the Gemiri Umurga, in Babylonian language. Umurga would, again, is judged to be very likely Amirigo. Amirigo, yeah. Umurga is Babylonian language for that. Umurgi in Saxon Germany. The Mirings, and Mirke, I don't know how this M-Y-R-C-E would be pronounced in English, and the Meringus were clans that your names that you followed across Europe. Ultimately, Mercia is found in Britain, is one of the seven great kingdoms of Great Britain in the ancient world, and then Amerigo in America. And we think, well, America is named after Amerigo Vespucci, and that may well be the case. There's another possible case, that at the time, a few decades before Columbus sailed in 1492, the English fishermen in Bristol, England, would go fishing off the coast of Iceland, and they would catch their cod, and then they would take them down and sell them to the Portuguese and the French and the Spanish, and they'd go back to England with the goods that they traded for those and sell it in England in an outfit again and go up and go fishing again. So they did that, and they sailed out of Bristol. Bristol had a high, a big drop in tide, like 20 or 23 feet. And so that when you got up into the harbor, you were actually in an estuary of the river, and the ships would be sitting in the mud when the tide was out. Now, most ships weren't built to withstand that, but the Bristol ships were. They knew how to design them, so that didn't bother them at all. So if you were ship-shape in Bristol fashion, you were well-built. At the time of the 1580s, or the 10 or 20 years before Columbus, there was a leading ship owner in Bristol whose name was Richard Amirick. A-M-I-R-I-C-K. Anyway, Amirick. I forget exactly how he spelled the last part of it, but it was how it sounded. And the sailors, the shipping, the fishermen would sail under his flag as the leading, he ran the entire group of ship owners. He had risen to that seniority post. When the captains came back from their voyages, they came directly to the ship owners' center in Bristol, and then they wrote on the main map there what they had found in their sailing. They were gradually accumulating working maps. They didn't want anybody else to have their maps. They guarded those very jealously. Ultimately, it was the English out of Bristol that launched a three-ship expedition under John Cabot. And he sailed over and down New England and ultimately disappeared. At the same time, Amerigo Vespucci, who was an Italian cartographer or map maker, was sailing with the Spanish fleet with a very bloodthirsty sort of admiral, according to historians. And they were sailing up the coast, the east coast of the United States, around the Gulf and up the coast. Well, nobody knows if they destroyed John Cabot's English ships. All we know is that the English didn't come back. But the Spaniards ended up with some pretty good maps. That would be one thing you would want, are the maps, the ship's maps, if you could get them. So the theory of one author is that the land was named after Richard Amerik, America, and Amerigo Vespucci got a hold of him. That's a possibility. But there's another way of looking at it, and I'm going to cover it here instead of later. Amerigo is an Italian name, and he was Jewish. That's the other interesting thing about Amerigo Vespucci. He was Jewish. And he was named after a famous prince, a Jewish prince. There was a Jewish kingdom on the border of France and Spain on the Mediterranean coast called Narbonne. I believe that was the name of it. He was a prince that ran that 400 years earlier. He was a hero in the Jewish, European Jewish history, this Prince Machir. So he was a Jew who was named Machir. That's not uncommon that you would, it's a name that was used. Amerigo was named for him, according to the biography about Amerigo Vespucci. He was named for Machir. Because if you think about a cartographer who was a commoner, why would he get his first name stuck on a piece of ground? Because he's a map drawer. Only royalty got their first name stuck on things. If you're a commoner, the best you could hope for is their last name being put someplace like a county, like Count Kosciuszko County in Indiana. There was a Polish general that fought under George Washington. His last name was Kosciuszko. That's how he got that. Doesn't matter, because Amerigo is Italian for Machir. Machir, of course, is the name of Manasseh's son. So by that direction, America is named after Machir. Hamakiri, America. Either through the shipper or through the map maker, who is named after a man who carried the same name as the son of Manasseh, whatever the case, the tracks lead right back to Manasseh. Bottom line is, God, the eyes of the Lord are on the sinful kingdom. This is out of Amos 9. This is the sifting verse. It's a passage. It's a good one to have in your list. Amos 9, verses 8 to 9. The eyes of the Lord God are on the sinful kingdom. Remember, Israel is not always a good example. In fact, most of the time is a bad example. And nobody's worthless. They can always serve as a bad example. And that applied to the tribes of Israel, unfortunately, too. And I will destroy it from the face of the earth, yet I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, says the Lord. For surely I will command and will sift the house of Israel among all nations, as a grain is sifted in a sieve, yet not the smallest grain shall fall to the ground. So, God is in charge of the migrations of the tribes of Israel. And thus, when we find them where they are, that's why they're there. Okay. What time? We have just a little bit of time left. I have to shift to... Does anybody have any questions while I'm shifting to what we're going to cover a little bit in the next one? Questions over any of it? All right. Let me go to... Boom. And... I have more material. I have 50 pounds of mud trying to stick it into a 5-pound bag. Tribe Tracker's Guide to History, Part 2. Review, we went through that. Bible superstructure of history, Israel history, self-evident prophecies, United States and Britain in particular, national names, archaeology, tribal and clan names, last thing, promises of blessings of the best places and things. This is in Genesis 49, the God of your father who will help you, the blessings of heaven, this is on Joseph, the blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and the womb, etc., etc. And it'll be on Joseph, who is separate from his brother. So Ephraim and Manasseh were to inherit these blessings pronounced on the tribe of Joseph. They were the tribe of Joseph. Why do we talk about the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh? There's a reason. Does anybody know the reason? Why we talk about, they are the tribe of Joseph, but why do they get called tribes themselves?
Jacob adopted them as his two sons.
Did you get that? Jacob adopted them as his sons. He adopted his grandsons and thus elevated them to tribal status. They then displaced their father in the lineup. Not that he bothered or minded, because they were his sons, you know? And he had the great honor of his sons becoming tribes themselves. To maintain the 12 tribes, technically there were 13 when you count Ephraim and Manasseh, but Levi didn't count as a tribe in the inheritance sense because it was stuck serving in the priesthood. No, it's not being stuck, I guess. Best places and things. Vast holdings of the British Empire, vast natural resources of America, gates of their enemies. Now, this is an important one. This enabled them to take advantage of all the other blessings. Land, they had mountain passes, Khyber Pass between Pakistan and India. And then the Straits of Gibraltar in the sea gates. We think about those, and we used to have those on the map, the United States and Britain in prophecy. The Straits of, I think it's Malacca, down by Singapore. England had that. Those are the narrow places. It's the shortest route for shipping to go, but if whatever nation controls the main fortified port off there has control of what goes through. Panama Canal. When we dug the Panama Canal, we made a sea gate. But before the Panama Canal, England and America controlled the other sea gate from the Pacific to the Atlantic, which was, what's the bottom of South America called? Which? Cape Horn? You know who controlled that? The Falkland Islands. England owns the Falklands even today. They fought a war over the Falklands in 1982. So, with all those sea gates. But that's not all. Air and space. America's controlled all the gates of her enemies ever since she became a superpower. The space race, air bases all strategically located all around the world. You know, we controlled gates that we didn't, America controlled gates we didn't even know existed as bases. Naval and but also especially air bases. Every week somebody sends me Stratfor, which is a think tank group, and they write things. And one of them is they track where the U.S. Navy is. The task forces are all positioned from one week to another. Well, when you've got a carrier task force or two carrier task force parked anywhere near you, you just have an air gate that they control. So America has had massive control, and through satellites and all of these things that, you know, we've had it. Had control of it, but we've just had it now. Eventually we'll be not having those. So that was one of the other tracks. You look for those dominating places that America and Britain have had. Legends and traditions. We talked about the Danites and the legend or the tradition that they were the father of the Spartans and Trojans. Colonized the Black Sea during the time of Judges. Trojan descendant of the king of Troy. His name was Brutus. According to tradition, founded Rome and then moved on to found London. London already existed in a certain way. It was a Celtic settlement, but he founded a city there for his people. The tribe of Asher, and probably involved other elements of tribes, all has to do with Norse mythology. Some of you probably went to see the movie called Thor. And when he landed so hard on his back, he was Thor for sure. But Thor was the hammer god. That's where we get Thursday. He's named after Thor. Friday is named after his mother, Freya. Wednesday is named after Odin by the English name Woden. as we'll see. Okay, Odin was his Scandinavian name. He was a priest king, when you read his history, from the Asar, or the Asia men, very likely another name for the tribe of Asher. And he was on the Asgard, in Asgard, which was a city on the Dawn River. And of course, in Norse mythology, Asgard is, you know, like Valhalla, it's heaven of some sort. But originally, it was just down on the Dawn River, north of the Black Sea. He led his people, this would be about the time of Christ or just before, led his people to the Baltic Sea, that's there in Scandinavia, and he ruled Saxland. And he had a lot of sons, and he moved them into positions of leadership on the people that he ruled. So there were already people there. He moved in, obviously, as having a certain charisma and significant power that he became the leader. Moved into Scandinavia, left his sons Vegdeg and Beldeg to rule Saxland. Now, and Thor was another son. That would be a little bit later. But the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, which is the ancient history of England, traces the Anglo-Saxon genealogy to Woden. That's their variation of Odin. I put a sort of a W sound at the beginning. Through his sons Vegdeg, or Vegdeg, and Beldeg, or Beldeg. So that you can see the sons' names very clearly, and Woden, just a W on the Odin. So, again, these are legends and traditions that connect the tribes and put them in the places that we would expect them to be. Tagged on to the Asir, which sounds very, very much like the tribe of Asher. Art history. My daughter has a history major and an art history minor from university, and she said, you know, I got more history in my art history classes than I did in my history classes, because modern history, especially in a liberal university like that one, with a few exceptions of good professors, art history is taught as sociology, liberal sociology. But art history, the art historians can be liberals too, but they don't care about the sociology. They want to know times, places, dates, dynasties, and who was ruling when, and what was happening here, and how that affected the art. So it turns out that the artsy crowd actually teach better history than the history crowd in a lot of places. The Scythians were noted for their vigorous art style, which was one of the formative influences on the development of Celtic art in Europe. Scythian and Celtic art are very, very similar. That's important because that's telling you that the Celts and the Scyths were very similar people, same culture, basically. Scythian burials, such as those in the mounds in these places in Russia, I can't pronounce it, are very elaborate and contain many artifacts decorated with fantastic animal motifs. There we go. Well, this is not so much of an animal motif as it is a Scythian battle taking place. So you've got a horseman with a sword or a spear, and you've got shields and swords. Notice they're all wearing trousers and boots, and there's a dead horse. And these are lions. They like miniature animals stuck in everywhere, thus these zoomorphic themes. And it's a comb that you put in your hair. It's a very beautiful piece. I believe that this one is located in the Hermitage Museum in Russia. They have a lot of the Scythian art because a lot of that took place on their what they controlled during the Soviet Union years. The timing of Scythian art, when it became an art style based on art historians, was in the early 700s B.C., in Syria, Phoenicia, and northern Israel. Well, what happened in the early 700s B.C.? That's when the tribes of Israel were being taken away by the Assyrians. Thus, it became known as Neo-Assyrian art, the new Assyrian style, different from their other style. Art historians can see that. I can even see that, which is remarkable. It is also called Phoenician art. Remember, the northern tribes were in league extensively with Phoenicia and had been since the time of David. Remarkably similar to Celtic art, this is Celtic art of some little soldiers wearing antler helmets in some cases. Again, zoomorphic, that means animal, juncture, inversion, bending the rear part of the body into an unusual way artistically. Animals arrangement in forms of a cross or a swirl, the recumbent posture, leaning back, lotus or palmette motif. They like lions, fallow deer, roosters, and raptors. Jewish art also, which is still also similar to this, focuses a great deal on roosters for some reason. And then they have composite creatures there that they call griffins. On the British coat of arms, they have a unicorn and a lion. But if you study them, there are tails that belong in other animals and some other things that belong in other animals. Here's a torque. This is the Celtic. There's the Scythian. What you have here is a rider on a horse, tiny little rider on the horse. Again, animal themes. Over there you have lions. And this is just a sampling, but you can see there's a certain similarity to the style there. They like those carvings. Celtic eagle on a helmet, and a Scythian belt buckle, actually, is what that is. Using the eagle. Now, here we have a lion. And you note, this is Celtic. This is Scythian, this is Celtic. But notice these little, this funny tail and the feet. The feet and the tail are all made out of exact tiny replicas of the rest of the animal. So they keep repeating the theme in a fantastic way. And it's a cat, obviously, a lion. This is the title page or the title T of the Book of the Kells, which is the Celtic, most famous Celtic book, one of their original books. We have here a cat. See the eye? In a recumbent posture, kind of a weird-looking cat. There's another cat, sort of a snaky cat. There's another cat up there. I counted them all. When you get up close and you can see the eyes, you can count 8 of them, just curled around. But again, it's a very similar style. This is on parchment or paper, and that one is carved in gold. That's just a little tiny sampling of the art history connections, but they do exist. I'm just introducing you to that. Linguistics. We've talked about linguistics, but this is another element. This is from Sharon Turner, probably Jewish. Sharon is a Jewish first name, 1827. He was a famous historian who compared the English root words with the root words of what he called Aryan, or from northern Persia. And he said, the important fact of a part of Armenia having been named Sakasina is mentioned by Strabo, ancient historian, by another place, and seems to give a geographical locality to our primeval ancestors and to account for the Persian words that occur in the Saxon language, as they must have come into Armenia from the northern regions of Persia. That's why we have an English is an Aryan language. Era or Iran was the name of that part of Persia. Now, Turner is the one, through his research in language in the 1820s and 30s, that solidified in British thinking that the Saxons, or the Anglo-Saxons, were in fact extracted from ancient Persia. They weren't Persians, but they were from that at a certain time. A more recent study done in the late 70s and early 80s was done by Professor Terry Blodgett at the Southern Utah University. His thesis is entitled Phonological Similarities in Germanic and Hebrew. His findings are that one-third, that's a large percentage, of the underlying structure of Germanic languages, that's German, Dutch, English, certain of the Scandinavian languages, are derived from Hebrew. And an example would be this. We say bashful, or we are abashed, and the term in Hebrew is ba'ash. We say rabble, you know, they're just a bunch of rabble-rousers. They say rab. We say cipher, which I guess that's an arithmetic thing. They say safar in Hebrew. Our arm is sore, the Hebrew it's sore. It's essentially the same word. We're cold and we shiver, they shaver. We don't feel good and we puke, they pook. We cook it too long and it's char. For them, it's chara. And if you think that's dumb, they say it's dom or dom. And the word for earth is eretz. So that's just a sampling off of the list that Blodgett had in his work that shows very, very clear connections between Hebrew and English, let alone the other Germanic languages. And that's another major track. You're following linguistics, the language itself, in addition to individual place names and tribal names. Historical maps of the ancient world were essentially drawn together in a book called Geography by Ptolemy, Claudius Ptolemaeus of Alexandria, Egypt. 2nd century AD, Roman cartographer, map maker. He believed in a round earth. The series of maps we'll look at now are essentially drawn off of or extracted from the research of Ptolemy. And he was in the 200s AD, but he was citing and using maps that were several hundred years or more old that he had access to. We don't anymore. They don't exist anymore in Alexandria, but his book exists. He was quoting historians, telling them where different kinds of peoples were and what their names were they were called by that were hundreds of years before, and they were quoting people that were writing hundreds of years before them. So the study of ancient history is getting bits and pieces and putting them together, tracking things through time. Okay, you saw this map. The northern kingdom is taken over into Assyria. That's there in captivity. In 650 BC, this is 70 years later, 720 to 650, that's right, 70 years later, we now have the Scythians up here, the Massagetae over there on the other side of the Caspian, peoples known as the Saka, showing up on maps that would have dated over there. The Cimmerians, as I mentioned, had begun to move this way, and the Assyrian Empire is losing a grip on all those people. They used the Israelites as buffers, putting them up against kingdoms they were having trouble with. And then as the Israelites sort of repopulated and developed a couple of generations later, they were in the business of taking over those areas and then ultimately helping to threaten the Assyrian Empire itself. That's 650 BC. Here is an example of how they did it. The Scythians were horsemen and archers, horse archers. There is a horse archer, a Scythian archer. You can tell he's wearing trousers, very clearly trousers, and he's shooting his lion with his short bow. They carry double recurved bows. Herodotus, who wrote, he was a Greek historian, said to be the father of history because he just wrote histories, but he wasn't really the father Moses was, if anybody was. But Herodotus wrote about the Scythians. He traveled among them for a while. And he said, in order to be a Scythian warrior, this was on the far side of the Black Sea where he traveled with them, you had to be able to fire 3 arrows at a target at 60 bow lengths distance. Now, these bows, I know people who make replicas of them. They would be about a meter long, maybe 40 inches. Not very long, double recurved and very complex. They've got wood and bone, wood and horn and sinew and rawhide on them. 60 bow lengths would be about 70 yards, or close to 70 yards. And they had to fire 3 shots and hit the target, but the 3rd arrow had to be in the air before the 1st arrow hit the target. Now, that just takes it to a whole another level of dexterity there. Well, that was necessary for horse archers. The research on the pull of the bows is that they were very heavy pulling bows, 100 pounds and more. The English war bows, which were not designed like that, they were just straight longbows. The English war bows, we know how heavy they were based on some water archaeology in England. The weak ones were 90 pounders, the heavy ones were 160 pounders. And the English would shoot them, they would pull back to get as much draw, they would have their head and their chest partway inside the bow. So when you call it shooting in the bow. So then they would release, they would pull their head back out of the way. If they forgot to once, they never forgot to do that again. It hurt, you know. So the Scythian archers were phenoms of the time. It gave them a lot of power. They tore infantry to shreds because they could ride circles around them. Literally. 300 BC, okay, we drop down through the Scythian times. We're 350 years later. I must have another map in between, but Alexander has taken over this whole section. He conquered a lot of the Scythians for a while. The Scythians moved further north into Siberia and over by China. where they fought with the Chinese for a few hundred years. Various groupings, the Massagetae may have been in that. Cimmerians had moved into Europe. They were connected now to the Gauls and the Celts. 300 B.C. is well before the Roman Empire was an empire. Rome was just barely a republic by this time. Barely a republic. So you had Celts, Gauls, and Gauls are just the Celts over there in France. Here is just a picture from a historical atlas of the different clans and sub-tribes and such that were found in Gaul at the time. And some of the names we found under Reuben and a couple of the others are found there. Here we have England at the same time and the groups that were found there. They're too small for you to read, but you can look them up easily enough in historical atlases. 150 B.C., we have a Parthian Empire developing down here in what would be Iran and Iraq. We have the Gauls up here, 150 B.C. The Gauls have not been conquered by Julius Caesar. Won't be for 150 years. They're in England. They're there. You've got the Gutons and Teutons have already gotten into Scandinavia. The Rocks Alani, evidently some of Zebulun is what our theory is, with there. Scythians here. Alans there, more of Zebulun. And the Yuchi in 150 B.C., otherwise known as the Massagetae, are coming back from China. Now, the Parthian Empire. Scythian origins, Massagetae enabled them to rise to power. Arch rival from Rome, mounted archers defeated the Roman general Crassus. Crassus was contemporary with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. They were triumvirate. And he decided that he would go and conquer Parthia and add it to the empire. His force was annihilated. He went in with, I think it was 10 or 15 legions. He came out with part of a legion. They were wiped out by the Parthian archers, which fought with the Scythian-style bows and tactics. The Empire of Parthia lasted from 250 B.C. to 226 A.D. It was a very powerful force. So right during the time of Christ, this is where the wise men came from where a lot of Israelites were. Of course, a lot of Jews were there too. Here is the famous Parthian shot, still spoken of today. One of the tactics they used repeatedly, and nobody would seem to get the knack of it, is they would ride in close to get the soldiers would throw up a shield wall to protect themselves from the arrows. So they would ride in close and mill around, the Parthians were, until the Romans or whatever soldiers they were fighting, they'd think, well, they're all confused. We can get them and yank them off their horses. They would drop their shields to run forward, and the Parthians aren't or disorganized. They're ready. So they would start riding straight away, firing those three arrow spurts just as fast as they could into the soldiers who had dropped their shield wall. So they were devastating to fight against. And the Parthian shot is shooting over the rump of the horse as you're riding away. Sometimes when somebody makes a wisecrack as they're walking away from a conversation, that's also called a Parthian shot. And that's what it's named after is this. Now, 150 A.D., the Parthian Empire is still in extent. We now have Rome. The Roman Empire is established in most of its territories. They've conquered the Gauls. They conquered the Celts. They haven't conquered the Goths or the Roxolani or the Sacca or the Alans or the Teutons. And they can't conquer Parthia, although they fight knockdown drag out wars with her ever so often. By 300 A.D., things are changing. Parthia is gone. They fell in 226. And what replaced them was the Sassanian Persians. There were two Persian empires. The first one was called the Achaemenids. That was when Esther was the queen of King Xerxes. He was an Achaemenid, was the dynasty name. After the Parthian Empire of 450 or so years, then the new dynasty was the Sassanian, or the Sassanians. And then they continued to rule from 226 until they were destroyed by the Islamic rise of Islam in the 600s. So we have the Romans, but we have all these, the Teutons and Goths in Scandinavia, the Visigoths, are the Western Goths, the Ostrogoths, meaning the Eastern Goths. Probably not all the tribe of Gad, because we're looking at Goth being very likely the name for Gad, but it's groupings of tribes, confederacies of tribes, elements of the ten tribes grouped together because they're the same culture. the Alans right behind them. Then in 500, suddenly everything just goes crazy by 500, because Rome fell in 476 after it fell a couple times earlier. It fell to the Visigoths, or the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. Yeah, the Visigoths first. Theodoric, I think it was, that ruled them for 33 years and rebuilt Rome. Then the Ostrogoths came down and sacked Rome again. And then the Vandals came through. I think Vandals, that sounds bad. Well, that's because everybody was afraid of them, and they kind of raided their way right through Europe and didn't make a lot of friends. The Alans were allied with them most of that time. And so they didn't make too many friends, even among those who would have been of an Israelite extraction. And so they just kept going. They went right on down through Spain, crossed over, settled in Carthage. For 80 years, they had an empire of Carthage that was the Vandal Empire. And they fought back and forth what was left of Rome during that time. Finally, the Vandals realized that they were beaten in war, so their king had died, so they just disappeared. The time they disappeared, a few weeks later, there was a vast landing of nearly 200,000 people on the east coast or west coast of England. Now the Vandals, interestingly, they came all the way down, fighting their way, settling for a while in France, moving on to Spain. They got down to the ocean, and they theoretically had never been sailors before, so they built ships and sailed over and took over Carthage. And then they went back and forth and fought with Rome for 80 years. Essentially, what you have then are the movement of all the different tribal groupings. These aren't individual tribes, but groupings of them. Up here at 500 AD is the invasion time of the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes moving into England and pushing, fighting with, you know, other Israelites, the Celts. Just because they're from Israelite extraction doesn't mean they don't fight with other Israelites. Israelites fought with each other regularly. Anglo-Saxon warrior, tribal and national traits. Now I'll skip through this. Manasseh, tribal trait. The word means making forgetful. It means something put out of place, slips the mind, is another way of saying forgetful. Benefit for that? See, remember Joseph said, I have gotten a family, I can forget what I've lost back home. So he named him Forgetful. Manasseh forgets differences quickly. A sense of fair play. One World War II, what did we do? Well, we went back and rebuilt Germany and rebuilt Japan, gave them new governments, helped them get started, and made them allies and competitors in business. Now, most people wouldn't do that. I don't think the Nazis would have done that if they'd have won the war, or at that time, the Japanese. But America did. So you got to say that's definitely a sense of fair play coming from Isaac. And the sense of fair play translates into rule of law. Fair play for everybody. Now, that's our theory. We follow it for the most part. Not everybody in America does that. It's from the root word in Hebrew, noshe, which means movement from its proper place. For example, God wrestled with Jacob, testing Jacob's determination that one time in Genesis 32. And early in the morning, he pushed a ligament or a sinew or something out of place. What the Hebrew name for the sciatic nerve is the git kanoshe. That's what they call the sciatic nerve. Now, if that was a sciatic nerve that he pushed out of place on Jacob, if you've ever had sciatica, you can imagine the toughness of Jacob to keep wrestling even with that kind of pain. The plural for women in Hebrew is not ish. Hoth, which it would logically be. Isha means woman. But Noshim, again, taken from movements from its proper place. So why would they do that? Well, one of the Jewish historians I was reading about says it's like this. A woman transfers her identity to her husband when she marries, takes on his name. It is also a Noshe, similar to Noshim. Noshe is also the name for a creditor who lends things. So he pushes his money out of place and gives it to someone else. But he demands an accounting, and he can't, because that man owes him. What was mine, I put out of place to give to you, but you have to pay it back with interest. And likewise, the woman transfers in the development of the concept here, transfers her identity to her husband, but expects responsible representation of her identity by him. And, responsible representation. That's the theory behind the U.S. government, the Republic of the United States of America. Responsible representation has been our catchword, or delegated representation is another way of calling it here. So you can see how a name can, and God names things for what they are. He named Abraham for what he was, Sarah for what she was, and all the others. So we know with the emphasis God puts in a name that it can have some ultimately prophetic implication. But it provides another track. New Testament tribe tracking. Well, this is extensive. I'll just hit a couple of high points. The 12 apostles will each rule in the world tomorrow, one of the 12 tribes of Israel. Under King David, of course, because David will rule all of Israel. The promise to our 12 tribes, Paul is saying this to, I think it's King Agrippa there in Acts 26, referring to the 12 tribes. He knew where they were. Paul was sent to the Gentiles, Peter to the circumcision. The other apostles, from what tidbits in history we have, went to where the rest of the tribes were scattered. James, in his introduction to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, the New Covenant chapter, Rachel weeping for her children. This is in Jeremiah 31. The hope for your future, bringing them back to their border. That's all in the New Covenant chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31 and the prophecy of the New Covenant is found in Hebrews 8. Why track the tribes? Who are the Israelites, Paul said? To whom pertain the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the service of God, and the promises, of whom are the fathers, from whom, according to the flesh, Christ came, who is over all the eternally blessed God. Now, part of that is referring to the tribe of Judah, especially because Christ was descended from Judah. The rest of it was applying to the tribes in general. Paul's countrymen, referring to Israelites, my countrymen according to the flesh. What tribe was Paul from? Benjamin. Of the tribe of Benjamin, circumcised the eighth day, an Israelite of Israelites, he said in Philippians. My heart's desire and prayer for God for Israel, this is in Romans 10. Romans 9, 10, and 11 talk a lot about the tribes. No distinction between Jew or Greek, for the same Lord over all is rich to all who call upon him. But his prayer is that Israel would be saved. Has God cast away his people? Certainly not. For I am of an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. Oh, that's where he's the tribe of Benjamin. In Romans chapter 11, verse 1. And he talks about, I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. Even the Israelites who were misbehaved so terribly and misrepresented God so badly to all the Gentiles or non-Israelites of the world, their day will come in the great white throne judgment. Or if they live through to the world tomorrow, millennium, then they'll have that opportunity. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for the sake of the fathers. Looking back, again, speaking of Gentiles, about Israelites, concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but concerning the election, the beloved. See, Paul's writing to Gentiles, and he said, the Jews, in this case, the Judaizers, are enemies for your sake, gospel-wise, but concerning the election and the work that God has done through the nations of Israel, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then into the future, oh, we got lots more here, but Jeremiah 16, God talks about, I will cast you out of your land. We've already read other prophecies about that, but he will restore, also in Jeremiah 16, verses 14 and 15, The Lord lives, who brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from the lands where he had driven them. It's a prophecy of when he will bring them back. The second Exodus, as we call that. And also Jeremiah 16, a little bit further on. I will send many hunters. We are the hunters. They shall hunt them from every mountain and every hill and out of the holes in the rocks and lead them back to the promised land. And this is basically our conclusion. Jesus is born of Israel, the tribe of Judah. Tribe tracking clarifies the end time prophecies and Christ's second coming. And finally, if God works in history, and he does, then he can and will work in our lives today and in the lives of the church today. And we need to be taking a lot of confidence in that. Okay. Any questions? I've tossed an awful lot of information out there. And I will be putting together a handout, which I'll send back, so everybody can have a summary of scriptures and key points. So, okay. Bible study is dismissed. Thank you for listening.